Welcome to Speaking in Maine on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network, a public affairs program dedicated to bringing you speeches recorded from around the state, given by experts lecturing on topics from environmentalism and sustainability to the global economy, politics, and beyond. I'm Gordon Fellis. Today's program features foreign correspondent Indira Lakshmanan, sharing an insider's view of the negotiations leading up to the signing of the Iran nuclear agreement. She spoke recently before the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations. Here giving introductory remarks is Tom DeMarco, member of the Midcoast Forum's Board of Directors.
Good afternoon and welcome to the October meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, coming to you from Point Lookout in Northport on the coast of Maine. And a particular welcome to our public radio audience reaching us through the good offices of the Maine Public Broadcasting Network, MPBN, and mpbn.org. I'm Tom DeMarco, filling in for Mac DeFord, our president. Founded in 1983, the forum is now in its 31st year. That's 30 years of bringing you on a monthly basis informed speakers on all aspects of foreign relations and U.S. diplomatic policy and often the lack thereof. Details about past and upcoming programs are available on our website at midcoastforum.org. Today we are delighted to bring you Indira Lakshmanan speaking on Iran. When a moderator introduces a speaker, it's often just reading from a sheet which has been passed to him by the speaker. So when you hear that so-and-so is the world's greatest expert on such-and-such, that's so-and-so is telling you that. Since I'm going to say some nice things about Indira, I want you to know this is my intro, not one that she passed me. Indira is a journalist, a foreign correspondent in the ilk that Hitchcock had in mind when he directed Joel McRae in the 1940 film Foreign Correspondent. That means she's a person who goes to the trouble spots of the earth, talks to the people who are either responsible for the trouble and or the victims of the trouble, and gives us the story in the grand tradition of the New York Times great Tilman Durden or Dexter Filkins. In this capacity, she has spent a year in the war zone in Afghanistan. She reported the fall of the Taliban from Kandahar. She reported the death of Deng Xiaoping from Beijing. She reported the overthrow of Suharto from Indonesia. And on a slightly cheerier note, she was just in August with Secretary Kerry in Havana to report on this rarest of all things in journalism, some good news, the raising of the American flag for the first time in more than 50 years over the embassy in Havana. She has reported for NPR, the Boston Globe, Bloomberg, Politico, Business Week. She's a frequent guest on with Gwen Ifills on Washington Week, on the news program with Judy Woodruff. And the place I first came across her on, I'm a Diane Rehm junkie, so she's often on as a guest on Diane Rehm. And when Diane is away, Indira is often chosen as the guest host. She has followed the story that she's followed most closely is the negotiations associated with what eventually became the Iran nuclear deal. In this capacity, she traveled with Secretary Clinton in her plane with a very small pool of reporters, and thus she had good access to the secretary. And similarly, when John Kerry took over, she traveled with him. Went wherever the story took her, to Vienna, to Lausanne, to Geneva, to New York. And if you heard coverage of the negotiations on any of the major channels, you would have, chances are, been hearing Indira reporting from the location. It's the story of a lifetime, and we're so pleased that she's here to tell us about it. Ladies and gentlemen, Indira Lakshmanan.
Thank you. Well, that is such a nice introduction. Thank you. I could not have written that myself, but I'm very grateful.
And it's really nice to be here speaking to all of you. I was delighted when I heard from Mac and from Tom about the makeup of your group and how many of you have been, like Jim, a former CIA officer and foreign service officers, and have had so much experience in being practitioners of foreign policy yourselves, that it's great to be able to speak to an audience who has some real knowledge about this, and I hope that in the Q&A we'll be able to engage in some interesting conversations and debates about what you think of the Iran deal and any questions you may have that I haven't answered. So I know that you've had quite a few speakers who have spoken to you in the last year or so about Iran. And so I wanted to make sure that my talk is really from a different perspective, a different point of view. And I thought that what I could offer is something I have that the other people you've had, you know, were doing something different. And what I've done is really covered the last 7 years of Obama administration diplomacy towards Iran, and specifically the last 2+ years of open diplomacy, traveling around, as Tom said, to various places in the world where John Kerry was negotiating and his deputy negotiators were negotiating with the Iranians and the other members of the so-called P5+1. So what I wanted to do was sort of give you the inside story of what happened on the road to the Iran deal that has been so controversial, so fought over on Capitol Hill. And, you know, something that struck me was that it's as among those who criticize it, it's as unpopular in Tehran as it is in Washington, as evidenced by the fact that just yesterday, Ali Salehi, who is the head of the Atomic Energy Agency in Iran, said in an interview that he had gotten death threats from Iranian lawmakers who were opposed to him negotiating with the United States or negotiating any kind of a deal to restrict Iran's nuclear program. So while definitely the Republicans and many of the Democrats in Capitol Hill, on Capitol Hill, opposed President Obama's Iran deal, I don't know anything about death threats. So at least that's a positive, that we didn't go that far in the dispute over this piece it's not a treaty, as many of you know. It's an international agreement. And I think it will be the cornerstone of Obama's foreign policy legacy, for better or for worse. We'll see what happens with it. But the path to that deal really started with an uncomfortable night in a vacant house very far from Washington, D.C. So I want to tell you about that story. It began in early July 2012 when President Obama authorized his chief advisor on Iran at the time, a man called Puneet Talwar on the National Security Council, and Hillary Clinton's right-hand man, a man called Jake Sullivan. They were authorized to fly secretly to Oman, to Muscat, and to have secret behind-the-scenes talks, direct talks, one-on-one with the Iranians. And this was very significant because it would have been politically explosive had this been known in Washington that this was going on. So it was all done completely cloak and dagger under the radar. Their travel was not put on any public schedules. They crashed on couches in a vacant U.S. embassy house in order to avoid being seen in any hotel. They were sort of spirited through a non-public entrance into one of the palaces of the Sultan of Oman. He had promised complete confidentiality in being a broker of these talks. It had been the record 115 degrees temperature just a few days earlier, so there was no chance of any kind of a media stakeout. The Iranians and the Americans entered a huge salon from different entrances. It's been described to me by the people who were there as having been a table that was big enough for a cabinet meeting, and ornate chandeliers, and everything about it was not an intimate setting, to say the least, for a very delicate encounter that was the first significant direct contact between the U.S. and Iran since the Iran-Contra affair. And we all know how that turned out, not so well. And so the Americans knew that there was a lot of pressure on them to not repeat that kind of a debacle and to make sure this went well. Now, this first meeting was really a get-to-know-you, no substantive progress took place. And they did not meet again in these secret talks in Oman until the following April. But what was significant about this was that it was in the summer of 2012. It was the culmination of already at that point diplomacy that had begun in the first minutes of President Obama's presidency. In his first inaugural speech, you'll remember in January of 2009, he referred to the idea that he would extend his hand to regimes that were unfriendly to the United States as long as they would unclench their fist. And this was first and foremost a reference to Iran. And Obama, one of his first things that he did in the White House privately was essentially enlist his administration to undertake a top-to-bottom review of the United States policy to Iran. And so that included, from the point of view of the Treasury Department, they immediately started studying sanctions. What kind of economic sanctions and pressure could be put on Iran to pressure them and get them to make a nuclear agreement, to essentially come back from the brink of what U.S. intelligence, European intelligence, Russian intelligence, Israeli intelligence felt was a secret program by Iran that Iran has always denied to acquire a nuclear weapon, to create a nuclear weapon. In the State Department, it was a top-to-bottom review of what kind of new diplomacy could be done in order to sort of shake up the process and make diplomacy work. In the Pentagon, it was a study of force posture and military options, and seriously looking at what would be the options if the U.S. were to strike preemptively at Iranian nuclear facilities, and would it be possible? Now, this is just an interesting side note. Bob Gates, who was Defense Secretary at the time, and Admiral Mullen, who was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, differed from Hillary Clinton, Dennis Ross, who was a senior advisor to the Obama administration on Middle East policy, and Tom Donilon, who later became the national security advisor, and some others, in that they said that they felt that a military option, although it was possible, was not wise, and that even if Iran were to get a nuclear weapon, that they felt it was not a good idea to take any kind of military action, and that at that point it would be better to contain them. And it's interesting that the military establishment felt that they should be prevented from getting a nuclear weapon, but they should be contained if they got one. Whereas Hillary Clinton, who was then Secretary of State, and as I said, many of the people in the sort of diplomacy apparatus said, no, we have to prevent them and we have to make the military option seem to be a real one, or else it's not going to be a genuine threat. At the same time, the U.S. intelligence community was essentially activated to do things like disrupt Iranian weapons flows to terrorists, to accelerate cyber warfare. Many of you have probably heard of Stuxnet, to disable Iranian centrifuges remotely, and increase surveillance, which ultimately led to the discovery of a covert Iranian nuclear facility that was underground, a facility called Fordo. Where they were enriching uranium dug deep into a mountainside near the holy city of Qom. So the president decided that the first and foremost he was going to prioritize diplomatic outreach. And he began that with a message in March, which is the Iranian New Year, Nowruz, where this was really the brainchild of a relatively junior State Department official, a young woman, who had this idea, why doesn't the president do some direct diplomacy to the Iranian people, record a message that will be shown in Iran directly so it's not mediated through anything else, put it on YouTube, and show that the American people are open to Iran and want a new relationship with Iran. So he did record this YouTube message, and it was greeted very positively, not only by reform-minded Iranians, but by American allies in Europe and elsewhere who had been, at that point, quite fed up with the Bush administration policy towards Iran, which they felt was going nowhere in terms of activating diplomacy and trying to get a nuclear deal. So at this point, we had the Sultan of Oman, who came forward in March of 2009, so just a few months into Obama's presidency, saying, I'm here, I have a relationship with Iran, I have a relationship with you, I can put together some talks for you. I can broker secret talks. And at the time, the White House very politely declined that offer, as well as other offers that came from the Swiss, from the Japanese, from private envoys, because they felt this was a president who had already been given the Nobel Peace Prize. He was the first African-American president. Maybe his very presence could be enough of a game changer that it could change Iran's approach, and the U.S. could do it without using intermediaries. That was their initial feeling, and it wasn't until 3 years later that they actually did sort of activate that Omani channel. So they were trying for a few years before to do it themselves. We know that in June of 2009, Obama sent a letter to Ayatollah Khamenei. It was a secret letter at the time. Khamenei did respond, but before anything could happen, any kind of dialogue between the two leaders, there was the Green Revolution, and as you know, the violent crackdown on the fraudulent results of the June 2009 Iranian election. So beamed all across the world, you saw satellite images of government-backed thugs cracking down on people who felt that their candidates had not been, you know, that the vote was fraudulent and they had not been fairly elected. And so that kind of put the kibosh on any kind of further diplomacy at the time. At the same time, a month later, three young American hikers strayed across an unmarked border between Iraq and Iran, were grabbed by the Iranians, and were accused of being spies. So you will, I'm sure, remember the Iranian hikers. That also complicated efforts to have nuclear diplomacy because suddenly there were three young Americans in custody in Iran accused of espionage, which they have said all along they were not involved in espionage. The same year, going on parallel to this effort, it was very interesting, Iran had a medical reactor that was actually initially built by the United States back in the 1960s when the U.S. was on very friendly terms with Iran under the Shah of Iran. And this medical reactor requires 19.75% enriched uranium, so what is called medium enriched uranium. And the Iranians had essentially run out of this, and they approached the international community saying, we need some kind of a deal with you where you're going to give us this medium-enriched uranium or we can't run this medical reactor. So over the course of several months in 2009, the international community came together and came up with a solution. You give us some of your uranium that you have, your enriched uranium stockpile, and the Russians will further enrich it for you to medium-level enrichment, and the French will fabricate it into fuel plates for use in your medical reactor. So everyone from the United States to the Russians to the Chinese and the French thought this was a great solution, and they offered it to the Iranians. And initially, the Iranians said yes in September of 2009. And then a couple of weeks later, for reasons that we don't really know, but apparently there was backlash from the right wing in Iran, they suddenly kiboshed it, said, no, we don't accept that after all. So the international community was extremely frustrated. This was one more thing where, you know, Obama came into a situation where the allies said George W. Bush did not do anything to try to work with us on diplomacy with Iran. Suddenly, the Obama administration was saying, yeah, let's do it. Let's come up with this offer. And when the Iranians said no to it, there was a lot of frustration, not only in Europe, but also in Moscow and in Beijing, because they felt they had this potential deal. This came right on the heels of, in September of 2009, the revelation by President Obama and the French and UK leaders standing next to each other at the G20 and revealing that Iran had the secret underground nuclear facility, which again cast a lot of doubt and suspicion on Iran and on, you know, despite the fact that Iran had been arguing for years, our nuclear program is strictly for peaceful medical and energy civilian use and nothing else, the international community said, well, if that's true, then why are you building this clandestine facility underground, under a mountain near a holy city where no one is supposed to be, you know, nothing like this should be happening? And also, why within a couple of months are you suddenly enriching uranium up to 20%? So the Iranians said, we're doing it because we need it for our medical reactor. And the international community said, but we offered you a deal to give you that. What the international community was upset about was here was Iran one step closer to high enriched uranium, which can be used for nuclear fuel, 80 to 90% enriched. And so this means once you're making 20% enriched uranium, you really are a lot closer to making bomb grade fuel if you want to. So at this point, the philosophy of the Obama administration and the strategy changed. And they went from, okay, diplomacy isn't working. Now we're really going to hit them with sanctions. And over the summer of 2010, there was what the chief sanctions negotiator on the U.S. side described to me as a Mack truck's worth of sanctions that Iran was being hit with every single week. President Obama himself called the Russian president Medvedev and the Chinese president Hu Jintao at the time and urged them to support U.N. Security Council resolution sanctioning Iran. That happened. That became the basis for a whole bunch of other sanctions. And week after week after week, Iran was seeing more and more bad economic news because of sanctions that were hitting. So the idea, again, the strategy here was squeeze them economically so they will have to come to the negotiating table. At this point, the United States started thinking about whether it would make sense to have a back channel to Iran, because these meetings between the so-called P5 plus one, which means the permanent five members of the UN Security Council, so the US, China, Russia, France, Britain, plus one refers to Germany, and Iran were not going anywhere. They would just get bogged down in these long, long, hours-long meetings with, you know, translation, with the Iranians constantly saying the same thing, talking about historical grievances, talking about the feeling that they felt they had a right to enrich under the Non-Proliferation Treaty, the other side saying, well, you don't have a right to enrich, you have a right to have a peaceful program, that's not the same as a right to enrich. And these same arguments were being rehashed again and again and again. So the Americans at that point started communicating quietly with the Omanis, with the Sultan of Oman and his intermediaries, to find out, do you really have a channel to Ayatollah Khamenei? Because nothing is going to happen if these talks aren't actually given, at the very least, a nod and a wink, if not approval by the Ayatollah. We're not going to go anywhere otherwise. So do you really have a channel? And this process of so-called validating whether the Omani channel would work or not really took a good 2 years, believe it or not. It took a trip by Hillary Clinton, which I was on, to Oman, which we didn't know at the time, that while we were out sitting by the pool, she was in this elaborate banquet with the Omanis, with a live orchestra playing, you know, John Philip Sousa's Liberty Bell, and she was sort of quietly leaning over to the Sultan and saying, do you really think the Ayatollah would be behind these talks? Because before she and others, including the president himself, were willing to sign off on the secret channel, they really wanted to feel that it wasn't something that the Iranians could back away from, or it wasn't going to be something that was going to be exposed and embarrassing with no result for the American side. At the same time, on Capitol Hill, the opponents of Iran, who are many, were really going into full throttle. And this happened both on the Democratic and the Republican side. Bob Menendez, a Democrat from New Jersey, I sat in a hearing that I still remember to this day on December 1st, 2011, where I was sitting as far away from him as I am from this table, and I thought he might have an aneurysm. He was so angry, I could see the veins in his head throbbing. And he was yelling at the Undersecretary of State and the Undersecretary of the Treasury and essentially saying, you have dragged your feet. It's been 2.5 years. You haven't stopped Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. You're not doing enough. And we need to put some very serious sanctions on. And if you're not going to do that through executive action, we are going to do it through congressional action. And what his committee, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, ended up doing was putting in oil sanctions that really were the key to squeezing Iran. What was interesting, though, was that even though the Obama administration initially opposed these central bank and oil sanctions on Iran, they worked with Congress to get it into a form that they were happier with, and then they spent the next 2 years hammering Iran, basically going around the world, particularly to China, to South Korea, to Japan, to India, to countries that were importing Iranian oil, and pressuring them to reduce significantly their imports of Iranian oil or become cut out of the U.S. banking system. That's a really huge sanction, as you can imagine, being cut out of the U.S. banking system. But there was no guarantee that China and India were or any of these countries were necessarily going to go along with it. But there was a lot of pressure put on them. Plus, the European Union imposed its own oil embargo. So these two oil embargoes went into effect in the middle of 2012. And the effect on Iran was really dramatic and almost immediate. And within the first year, so oil is the number one revenue earner for Iran, and within the first year of those oil sanctions, Iran lost $54 billion. So that's a lot of money if that's your most significant source of government revenue. If you're getting $100 billion 1 year, and the next year you're only getting $46 billion, that's a pretty big difference. So sanctions were really increasing. It was taking a hit. There were more and more sanctions on energy, on banking, on mining, ports, insurance, etc. And as we came into 2013, something really interesting happened, which was that both the Iranians and the Americans came into the year not quite where they wanted to be. On the Iranian side, the nuclear program had stopped advancing as quickly as it had been before, because frankly they were losing money. They were being sanctioned on all sorts of fronts, dual use technology, etc. They couldn't advance their program as quickly as they wanted. On the American side, they felt they were starting to run out of sanctions. They were starting to run out of tools to use without it having a boomerang effect on the global economy or even on the U.S. economy. So the result of that, I was told by American and Iranian officials, is that essentially it was time to talk. And that's the atmosphere we were in where we went into these secret talks that I described in the summer of 2012 and then coming into 2013. Now, meanwhile, I was in Almaty, Kazakhstan in early 2013, where John Kerry's team, made up of his Undersecretary of State, Wendy Sherman, and her team were negotiating with the P5+1. And again, they had this feeling of sort of hitting their heads against a brick wall, where they were just getting these long, long lectures, as I described, the same thing about Iranian grievances, and they weren't getting anywhere on the issue of how do we limit this nuclear program in a way that we can then lift sanctions for you. And one of the big keys here was that in March of 2013, Bill Burns, who was then the Deputy Secretary of State, led another delegation to Oman, another secret one. They didn't even fly commercial this time because Bill Burns is recognizable enough. They didn't want to be spotted anywhere. They met in this secret seaside remote villa belonging to the Sultan. Again, everything had to be done very much under the radar, not be noticed. And what they were able to agree on in that meeting was, okay, we are going to try to have a deal, and we're going to have a two-step process. The first step will be an interim deal that will limit the most sensitive aspects of Iranian work in exchange for limited sanctions relief. And then the second step will be a larger push to get a complete nuclear deal. So that agreement was made, although they didn't agree on any of the specifics of how exactly that would be accomplished. Then in June of 2013, something really significant happened that, you know, could have been the biggest game changer of all, which was the election of President Hassan Rouhani in Iran. So he was backed by, it's not that he is a reformer, but he was backed by moderates and backed by reformers in Iran. Hatemi and Rafsanjani and others essentially threw their support to him in the final days before the election. He was elected, much to the surprise of many people, actually all the way to the White House, who thought that a hardliner like Jalili, who'd been the nuclear negotiator, was going to be elected. Instead, Rouhani was elected. And what was significant about this was that Rouhani was himself a cleric who, as a young man, had been a follower of the Ayatollah Khomeini during the 1979 revolution. And he had a line in to the current Ayatollah Khamenei, and he sort of had the credibility with the clerical community as well as with the reformist community. And so he was seen as someone who could be a bridge. And he campaigned on a platform of getting sanctions lifted and reducing Iran's isolation from the West. Now, at no time did he ever say anything that could be construed as pro-American in any way. really, his aim was, let's get sanctions lifted, let's get what they felt was Iran's unfair isolation lifted. So now these secret talks are continuing, but suddenly they take off like that. This, as I said, really was the game changer. And in August, again, unbeknownst to all of us at the time in the sort of diplomatic and journalist community, no one knew about this. And it was really only the very small number of people involved in these negotiations, a handful of people on each side who knew about this. These negotiations continued, and the United States said for the first time, we are willing to consider a limited domestic enrichment program for Iran if there are proper safeguards, verification, intrusive inspections, etc. And that, again, sort of broke the logjam because the Iranians had said that they were never going to agree to any kind of a nuclear deal that didn't allow them to maintain some level of domestic enrichment. They say it's for the purposes of national pride, that this is a scientific achievement of Iran, that Iran has learned the nuclear fuel cycle. Iran's critics and doubters say, well, it's because they want to still keep open the possibility of using an industrial-sized nuclear program, nuclear energy program, to be a bridge to a nuclear weapons program. Of course, time will be the only one that tells about that after the 10 to 15 years of this program passes, and once some of the more onerous restrictions are lifted, we will see, of course, what Iran does at that time. But so now talks really took off. By November, we were meeting in Geneva. Wendy Sherman was leading these talks, and the sort of secret channel and the official channel merged into one, and Wendy Sherman had to tell her P5 plus one partners, as well as the Israelis and the Saudis who didn't know about this, guess what? We've been secretly talking to the Iranians for a year, and here's this deal, that this preliminary deal that we've kind of agreed on. As you can imagine, the partners of the United States were not thrilled about this. I think some of them, like the Germans, were kind of like, well, great. I mean, if you've got a preliminary deal, let's look at it. Some of the others were really not happy of having been cut out of the process, and that included the French, who felt that the United States was, you know, they didn't like the fact that they were being cut out on the sidelines. And the French foreign minister, Laurent Fabius, really made a stink about it publicly at the second round of talks in November. There were three rounds of talks in October and then in November. And he made a big stink and said, we're not going to agree to this. You know, we have to talk more. So it was another few weeks before they came back to the table and were able to agree on this joint plan of action, which was a way to limit the 20% enrichment of Iran and give limited sanctions relief. And then what was really interesting was that we were told, okay, in 6 months, we're going to have a final deal. Which is interesting, Rouhani brought in some really sort of savvy Western-oriented negotiators. He brought in Javad Zarif, who had been a former ambassador to the United Nations, very smooth, had studied in the United States. He brought in Ali Salehi, who had been a previous foreign minister but happened to be a nuclear physicist who had studied at MIT. And suddenly everything changed. The negotiations started being conducted in English to just speed things up. There were few of these long lectures about grievances and more sort of practical, okay, what are we going to do? How many centrifuges do we have? How many are we going to get to keep? That's not to say that it became easy, because what Zarif said initially was, I need to get this done in 6 months. I have only a six-month window that Iran's conservatives will allow me to negotiate with you people, so I need to get this done fast. As we know, it ended up taking 2 years. And that is because, the Americans say, that is because the Iranians dug in their heels very hard and were unreasonable about their demands. And one of the things that the Ayatollah said publicly, he would often create new red lines that made it very hard for his own negotiators. For example, in July of 2014, he said, okay, Iran now has 19,500 centrifuges. We need to have 190,000 centrifuges. So he basically said that the program had to increase tenfold as opposed to reduce. So all the American negotiators you know, slapped themselves on the head and said, what are we going to do now? And it, you know, dragged on. It wasn't until the following year, really till April of this year in Lausanne, that they were able to come up with an agreement for Iran to keep only 5,000 centrifuges operating. One of the things that was really important in all of this, though, was personal relationships. There was a lot of technical stuff that went on where the Energy Department, nuclear experts on the United States side, were constantly mapping out so-called breakout scenarios, meaning how long would it take for Iran to break out from safeguards and create a nuclear weapon. They were scratching them out on whiteboards and wiping them clean every night to protect classified information. But as much as it was a technical discussion, it also was something that really, you know, rose and fall on personal relationships. And John Kerry is the Secretary of State who, it's very clear, prioritizes the importance of personal relationships. And in the very first time when he met with Javad Zarif, which was at the UN General Assembly 2 years ago, it was supposed to be just a hello handshake, but he ended up pulling Zarif into a side room on the side of the UN Security Council and speaking to him for half an hour, and exchanging email addresses, exchanging direct telephone numbers, and sort of trying to establish a rapport, which ended up being very important as they negotiated over the next 2 years. The same was true of Energy Secretary Ernie Moniz, who was brought into the process this year. He's a nuclear physicist who used to be a professor at MIT, and he sought to create a personal relationship with Ali Salehi, who was a student at MIT in the same department when Moniz was a professor. They didn't know each other at the time, but Moniz was sort of milking that connection they had to Cambridge in the 1970s. Sort of reminiscing about it, when Salehi had his first grandchild, Moniz showed up at one round of talks with a baby onesie with MIT on it and a bunch of other logo stuff. And, you know, it was really trying to sort of say, hey, we're human, create a connection. That doesn't mean we're going to give you a break on centrifuges, but, you know, let's at least try to talk in a civil way. So that was important. One of the fun things was that on the sidelines of all this, you know, the negotiating team run by Wendy Sherman made 69 trips across the Atlantic over 2 years and spent so much time away from their families and missed 2 Fourths of July in a row this year and last year. And, you know, we're constantly going back and forth. And they had this saying that solving the Iran nuclear deal was like solving a Rubik's Cube, because there were so many things, nothing could be solved in isolation. And, you know, just trying to solve one thing would mess up the other things. And by that, she meant that how many centrifuges you have affects what your enriched uranium stockpile is, affects what your reactor, your potential plutonium reactor is like. I mean, everything affected everything else. So one of the Energy Department guys called Kenneth Aviel made up these wonderful little Rubik's Cubes with each side was imprinted with a different challenge. So one was, you know, enrichment, one was sanctions. You know, he made all these great little Rubik's Cubes and passed them out to everyone. Another time when the Iranians really were denouncing Wendy Sherman because she had said some very critical things about Iran in public testimony in front of Congress. She had referred to Iranians as having deception in their DNA, a line which she has since apologized for, but has never, you know, from the substance of it, has always said they have deceived us again and again and again, and we have the proof over the years they've deceived us. But the way it was phrased upset Iran, and she started being caricatured in Iranian newspapers as a sly fox, as a deceptive fox. So her team, who was incredibly loyal to her, made up these T-shirts that said Team Silver Fox, because she has this shock of silver hair. And so they rallied behind her and they wear their Team Silver Fox T-shirt. So a lot of, you know, camaraderie was built among these people, a good thing, because they had to spend months and months in hotel rooms together pulling all-nighters in April of this year, which was the deadline for the for getting a framework deal. I went to Lausanne twice with Kerry in the month of March. And so, you know, we were there for weeks on end. And the last two nights were all-nighters, not just for the reporters who were waiting up all night long for what was going to happen, but they were all-nighters for John Kerry and his team themselves, who were working on fleshing out the very last details. I thought it was interesting that when I was interviewing just recently some of the Americans about what happened now that the deal was passed and over, one of the details that was given to me was that every time that they went overseas for these negotiations, Wendy Sherman would have a team dinner. And they had, you know, DiCapo's Pizzeria in Vienna was definitely the crowd favorite. They would have a team dinner, and she would go around the table, and she would ask everyone, what chances do you give for us getting a nuclear deal right now, if I have to ask you right now? And everyone would give their percentage chances. And essentially, at every single one of these meals, more than half of the table gave the chances under 50%. And one of the most experienced people on the team, a nuclear expert and negotiator who negotiated the SALT treaty with the Soviets, so he has really been around, he kept his answer, his guess, in the low single digits until the very end, which tells you something. And it was only the sanctions negotiator who ever was above 50%, because he believed truly that sanctions had forced Iran to the negotiating table and that it was just a matter of time, that it was inevitable that they would have to agree to nuclear limits. But he was really the only one who, up until the very end, thought it was going to happen. So for me, one of the most striking things was the final round in Vienna, where they were supposed to come up with a deal by June 30th. The talks ended up extending an additional 2 weeks. They actually got the deal on July 14th. But it was one of those things where I think the Americans felt they weren't going to get another extension from Congress, that Congress was going to slap on more sanctions. At the same time, they said to the Iranians, don't think that you have us over a barrel. Just because we can't get another extension doesn't mean we can't just walk away from this. I mean, we're not going to agree to some bad deal that you want. This is what the Americans said they said. And, you know, you saw the sort of dynamics of this international negotiation happening in the room. And one of the things I thought was most interesting was the Russians, despite the fact that there was so much tension between the U.S. and Russia over Ukraine, stuck with the rest of the P5 plus one on Iran very hard. And Sergei Lavrov, the foreign minister, you know, oftentimes would tell the Iranians, come on, no, don't look at me. I'm not going to side with you. We're with them. Let's get this deal done. And so on the final day, when they stayed up all night and they finally agreed on what would be the last, you know, what would be the deal that would last for 10 to 15, some aspects, 25 years, in a small room at a United Nations office in Vienna, the foreign ministers went around the room in an alphabetical order. They made some comments about what they thought the significance of this day was. And this was described to me by people who were in the room, because it was only the foreign ministers and their top aides who were there. So the French foreign minister, Laurent Fabius, said, this is Bastille Day. And I can't help but think this is not just a coincidence, and I hope that this deal will have a great and grand history like Bastille Day has had for France. And Zarif of Iran said, this ends the unjust isolation of Iran, and I hope it will be the beginning of a new chapter for Iran and the world. And John Kerry, because of alphabetical order, was the last one to speak. And he said, when I was a young man, I was just 23, and I went off to war. And I experienced that war, and then his voice started to break. And then he collected himself and he said, and since then, my feeling has always been that force is sometimes necessary, but you always have to exhaust all diplomatic means first. And according to the people who were in the room, they tell me that around the room, there were many tears coming down the faces of people who were moved by Kerry's remarks, including some of the Iranian negotiators. And they came out, they gave us a press conference, we knew that the deal had been done, And John Kerry put down his crutches. Remember, he had broken his leg. There were a bunch of medical mishaps that happened that delayed this whole process. Put down his crutches, sat backstage to watch President Obama's presentation from the Rose Garden on his iPad. And when it was all finished, Zarif came around, patted Kerry on the back, shook his hand, and said, "Let's stay in touch." And that is the story of the Iranian talks. So.
Wow, Indira, that's something. I got a bunch of questions here, and more coming, I think. Jan, will you help with that? Could you talk to the Iranian side of the negotiations, and who did you find to be a good source, forthcoming, and trustable?
Yeah, good question. We did talk to Iranian negotiators. I mean, they were sometimes more accessible than others. And I will say that by the end, it was really in Lausanne and most of all in Vienna in the final round that they became most accessible to us. And I think that's because they realized that if we only talked to American and European and Russian negotiators, we were going to have one narrative. And that if we also talked to them, that their narrative would go out in the American press. So it was really a matter of when they decided we were useful to them. And I will say that another source that was useful was Iranian state media reporters, because there were plenty of reporters from Iranian official media, and they essentially act as a voice, a mouthpiece for the Iranian government. So sometimes fellow reporters were useful because they were able to tell us what was being said in their private briefings.
I was shocked by what you said about Wendy Sherman, that she actually said out loud that the Iranians have DNA in their, have deception in their DNA. I mean, she's close to their negotiations. Is she right?
Well, she was the lead negotiator. I mean, you could say John Kerry was ultimately the lead negotiator, but when he was not there, she was the main person negotiating. I don't think I could answer a question saying that anyone has deception in their DNA. I don't think I could say that about any group or any person. But it is true that the Iranian nuclear program has been full of cheating and deception, and that is why the International Atomic Energy Agency of the United Nations and why the United Nations Security Council have repeatedly sanctioned and put out reports about Iran, despite Iran's denials of having any interest in ever having a nuclear weapons program.
So it was the government postures, not that of the negotiators she was referring to.
Yes.
Okay, good. I have a whole bunch of questions about Israel. How do you view Netanyahu's opposition to the deal? At what point was Netanyahu informed, and how important was his opposition? Do you think the present Israeli government will be successful in torpedoing the agreement?
Well, I'll take that last question first. The Israeli government has not been successful in torpedoing the agreement in that it got through Congress. There was a blocking majority that was able to prevent a measure of disapproval from going forward. So there was a very well-funded campaign led by AIPAC that sought to sink the deal, and that did not happen. On the question of why does Netanyahu not trust the deal, Netanyahu has made this very clear. He has said from the beginning that he believes that any nuclear deal with Iran should have left Iran with no nuclear program, with no right to enrich whatsoever, no enrichment capacity. So in his feeling, the original sin was committed when the U.S. agreed behind closed doors to allow for Iranian enrichment at low levels. By low levels, I'm talking about 3.5%. So that's considered low enriched uranium. If it's 5% and below, that's low enriched uranium. And to not allow, the Americans said, we're never going to allow that 20% enrichment, that medium enriched, we're only going to allow low enriched. But Netanyahu and his backers never wanted Iran to have any enrichment capacity at all, nor the ability to have an industrial-sized program in 15 years, which essentially Iran will have. After the course of this deal is done, Iran will be allowed to have an industrial-sized uranium enrichment and energy, nuclear energy program.
Evidently, there was a story in the Times today, I missed it, but that Iran has just tested a potentially nuclear weapon-carrying missile. Is this a violation, as you see it, of what they agreed to?
So that's a good question. It's come up in Iran circles just in the last 24 hours, the argument over whether this is a violation of the deal or not. The deal is not about missiles or ballistic missiles. And that was a big controversy at the very beginning of the negotiations, because there were a lot of people who said this deal should not just cover the nuclear program, it also should cover the ballistic missile program. In the end, the P5 plus one, including the United States and Iran, agreed that no, the negotiations would simply cover, would only cover the nuclear question, because they couldn't address all of the questions and all of the problems that the United States and the international community have with Iran, which include supporting terrorism, which include ballistic missiles, which include a number of things, and they felt they couldn't address all of those. They had to narrowly look at the nuclear part. So under that, it would seem that this is not a violation of the Iran nuclear deal, but it certainly does not engender trust if they're further developing ballistic missiles. Although, as I saw one commentator say, does the Iran nuclear deal say that Iran's not allowed to have an army? So, you know, it doesn't. Yeah. So in that respect, for example, one of the things which the United States is quite proud that it got as part of the deal is a further limit on an arms embargo for Iran, a UN arms embargo which lasts an additional 5 years, and a ballistic missiles embargo on Iran that lasts an additional 8 years. And I'm sure you will have heard that the critics of the deal have came out hard after this and said, why are we lifting the arms embargo after 5 years? Why are we lifting the ballistic missiles embargo after 8 years? It's outrageous. Iran is still a state sponsor of terrorism. You know, which it is under the U.S., it is a state sponsor of terrorism. But what was interesting was that the way the U.N. resolution was written that included that arms embargo and missiles embargo, they actually both should have been listed immediately upon the day that Iran came to a nuclear agreement. So the U.S. said, hey, we got an extra 5 years and an extra 8 years out of them when they should have been lifted immediately. So that, again, how you view that question depends on how you see the nuclear deal, I would say.
We've got a couple of questions that ask you to tell us what your nose is telling you about the Iranians' motives. By being close to the negotiations for so many years, have you developed a sense of what makes Ayatollah Khamenei tick and what he's thinking, what drives him?
I wish I could say I did, but I think that not even the top CIA analysts we have for Iran have a sense of what exactly makes the Ayatollah tick. What we do know is that Iran is a complex political society, and it's not sort of unipolar. It's not monolithic. There are various bases of power, and the clerics and the IRGC, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, are bases of power that are different bases of power. As we said, the really hardliners in the Iranian parliament threatened to kill and put in cement the Iranian nuclear negotiators. So very kind of Tony Soprano in their attitudes there. But, you know, what makes the Ayatollah tick? He has just said a couple of days ago that he's banning all further negotiations with the United States. So I think he's made it pretty clear that this negotiation was strictly about the nuclear deal and that it's not about a rapprochement with Washington from his point of view.
What was the political makeup of the Iranian team at the negotiations? I mean, we know that Iran is split with hard right and fairly moderate. It sounds like Zarif and Salehi were somewhat liberal, at least they were approachable. Were there hardliners on the team?
There were no hardliners on the team. The team was created by President Rouhani, who himself had been a former chief nuclear negotiator for Iran about 10 years ago when it was just the Europeans who were negotiating with Iran before the U.S., Russia, and China got involved in the talks. And interestingly, in his writings, he had written a book before he became president, he actually spoke about sort of chuckling up his sleeve and saying, ha, 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 boy, did we hoodwink those Europeans. You know, while we were doing the talks, we managed to continue to build our program. So that didn't engender a lot of faith and goodwill on the American side to go back and read that and say, this is a guy who gloated about hoodwinking the Europeans and building the program over those years. So again, like I said, it's not as if he's pro-American in any way, but the people who he put in charge of his negotiations, namely Zarif and Salehi, are two absolutely smooth lifetime diplomats, educated in English-speaking countries in the U.S. and the U.K., incredibly smooth, with deep ties in this country, who know how to play the game, know how to do the diplomacy game, and did it quite effectively. They are not hardliners. They would belong to what we would call the moderate or reform-minded group in Iran, and that is why they have been threatened by the hardliners, who were very much against them being involved, or Iran, period, being involved in this kind of a negotiation.
A couple of questions here about the negotiating team. I think we're all charmed by the idea that you got to meet all these people and got to know who was who, but how many people were on our side of the negotiating team, and who were some? I mean, you've mentioned Wendy Sherman. Who else was?
Right. Well, so there were dozens, if you count all the experts who were nuclear energy experts, who were sanctions experts. But the main crew, the main delegation. I'm sort of saying if you count everyone, the main crew of the delegation was about 10 people. So it was Wendy Sherman, it was Richard Nephew, who was her chief sanctions negotiator before he was replaced by a guy called Chris Bachmeier. It was Adam Zubin from the Treasury Department. I mean, it was various people, but about 10 of them who, yes, I got to know quite well. One of the funny little asides of this was that these people, as you can imagine, got to know each other really well, spent way too much time together, and got pretty punchy sometimes when they were having to do these all-nighters. And one of the funny stories was that they were sitting up at night, you know, one night through these interminable negotiations, joking about who would play their bosses in a movie version of themselves. If the movie of the Iran talks to them, I don't know if that would be an interesting movie to watch or not, but I mean, I'd certainly pay my $10 to go see it. But they all agreed that Ted Danson would play John Kerry, that Javier Bardem would play Ernie Moniz, and for those of you who have seen Ernie Moniz's famous hair, I think they were thinking of Javier Bardem in No Country for Old Men with that incredible shock of hair. And then, of course, Meryl Streep would play Wendy Sherman. So those were the top three, and you'd have to sort of know the other characters to appreciate the people who they were casting as the others.
One question about the Sultan of Oman. What does it imply that he was willing to broker these Muscat meetings? Is he an ally that we have not been properly appreciative of?
I think he's been very appreciated in the important ways. I've been on trips to Oman with both Hillary Clinton and John Kerry, where, again, unbeknownst to me and the others at the time, our Secretary of State was in the back room with the Sultan thanking him profusely for, you know, his role in this. You know, he's someone who has stayed pretty below the radar. Oman is a very small country, a kind of sleepy sultanate on the Arabian Peninsula, and he's not sort of stuck his neck out and gotten involved in international affairs. But one thing he has always had is a good relationship with Iran and a good relationship with the United States. Pretty much the only country who you could say has good relationships with both the U.S. and Iran. So he really had a unique position. And if you remember, it was the Sultan of Oman who brokered the release of all three of those American hikers. And I suspect the Sultan of Oman, although he's very ill right now, but I suspect that his people are probably also trying to work on the release of an American journalist from the Washington Post, an American, Iranian-American journalist from the Washington Post, an Iranian-American pastor, Christian pastor, and an Iranian-American former Marine, all three of whom are being held in Iran for years now. Who need to be released, who were unfairly, it seems, accused of espionage.
Is the could the correspondent who was just found guilty of spying in Iran actually be a spy?
Just referring to the Washington Post guy. His name is Jason Rezaian. No.
Rezaian, yeah. And if not, is this an attempt by the right wing to somehow undo or kill the nuclear agreement.
It's an attempt by the right wing to isolate the forces of moderation, to make sure that there's no U.S.-Iranian rapprochement, and to create problems for sure. I mean, it's been sort of documented and reported that the that Jason Rezaian, this Washington Post reporter who was born in California, whose dad was originally from Iran and whose mom is not Iranian, but he took Iranian citizenship simply to be able to be based in Iran. So this is a sort of question where, I mean, he's an American. He's born in America. He's only even half Iranian ethnically. But he took an Iranian passport because in order to live in Iran, it's extremely difficult to live in Iran as a foreigner to get accredited with a visa. And by taking an Iranian passport, he was able to live in Iran. Unfortunately, it also made him vulnerable to Iran saying, well, you're an Iranian. What are you doing communicating with the United States? Well, it's his job to communicate with the United States. He writes for the Washington Post. It's his job to interview American government officials. And one thing they've accused him of is of writing a letter to President Obama. I don't know whether or not he wrote a letter to President Obama, but one wouldn't think that that's espionage.
I'm going to end with two questions about the role of journalists. As the negotiations progressed, who decided when to allow journalists access to the players, and at what point was that?
Well, all of the negotiations that were public and official, so that means years of these P5 plus one negotiations, which took place in Istanbul, Moscow, Beijing, Almaty, Geneva, these were all public. I mean, we didn't get to go into the room, but we certainly were allowed to come to the event and be corralled into whatever press pen they put us in and negotiate, I mean, and get talks with the negotiators and get background conversations with them about what was going on. We were not allowed to report on the secret talks because nobody knew about the secret talks. So it was only after the fact that people like me went back and reported, you know, talked to the people who were involved and discovered what had happened at the secret talks.
So for instance, the meeting that Hillary Clinton had in Muscat when you were at the pool, at some point she told you about that, but when was that?
It was only years later when when her staffers actually told me about it when I interviewed them for these stories.
We ended up with a two dozen more questions. I'm going to send you home with homework. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Foreign correspondent Indira Lakshmanan here on Speaking in Maine. You can find this and other Speaking in Maine programs in the on-demand section of our website, mpbn.net. Charles Beck is our executive producer. For Speaking in Maine, I'm Gordon Fellas.